Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeta podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWeta world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeta episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we're headed back to the eastern coast of our continent for part two of the truly awesome Aksum Empire. Such a great and influential one it was. A shout out to my Eastern Africans out there, AfriWeta is back on your shores. I do apologize in advance for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeta across all the platforms, where we shall be posting interesting facts, stories, and updates, as well as links for further study for all you lovely people. And please, please, please tell your friends and families about us. For now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. So, there is a lot to get through in this episode. So, this is going to be the briefest of brief recaps from part one. So, please, please, please go and listen to it. So, in part one, we discovered the origins of the Aksum Empire, from the Damat Kingdom's decline to the rise of the Kingdom Aksum, which then formed the grounds for the Aksum Empire. We got to understand how it was able to become such a powerhouse by controlling and dominating the lucrative trade ports along the Kibari. So Kibari is actually Red Sea in Tigrinya. We also talked about its expansion, conquering the very many lands around it, most notably Yemen, and on the continent, the mighty Kush Kingdom. We uncovered how it became wealthy through trade with foreign civilizations, from the Indians and Chinese, and closer to home, the Arabs, and then even across to the Europeans. We even managed to get our heads around the dating system that was so complicated, but is also still practiced today, which explained the difference in the New Year's and Christmas days celebrated in Ethiopia from the rest of the world. And then we were introduced to the culture as well as the people. So yes, part one was jam-packed with a lot, and even then it barely scratches the surface. So please go and have a listen. But since you're here, finish this episode and then go and have a listen. Yep. So, the modern location. For those of you who weren't with us for part one or are new to AfriWeta, please make sure you get out your map so you can locate where we are today. And those of you who did your homework, well, just talk amongst yourselves. So the Aksum Empire's territory and dominance span from what is today's nations of Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, parts of Sudan, and Somalia, what is mostly we call the Northeastern Africa. And then from there, you'd cross over the Kibari into modern-day Yemen, which is in the South Arabian Peninsula. The city of Aksum, from where the empire derived its name, was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in AD 1980. Now that we're all caught up on the basics, let's dive right into it, starting with the way in which this empire was governed. So the Aksumite Empire had a centralized government based out of the city of Aksum. And this was ruled by the Negusta Nagast, which translated to King of Kings in the ancient Aksum language of Geaz. Today, you can go and visit the city, which hosts more than 100 stelae, or stela, or obelisks, which are basically standing commemorative monuments with written texts, images or both, of people and events. Our African fam in Egypt have two terms that describe these monuments. First is ahau, which comes from aha, which means to stand. And the other term they use is wedj, W-E-D-J, which translates to decree. And the origin of wedj is wedj nesu, which means a royal decree. For the Aksum Empire, it is most likely that they were funeral monuments for their kings and royals. So you see what I did there? I managed to circle back to governance from that little anthropology segue. As an aside, if you do know the terms that the Aksumites would have used, please share them with us on our socials or leave a voice note on the Anchor app. So, although in the high echelons of power, succession politics was not that smooth, with conflict and great tension, for a time these did not seem to actually negatively impact the empire's running. When it came to the lower and more localized levels, the empire employed different tactics to control the many territories under it. The most commonplace strategy seemed to be that they allowed for the tributary states to maintain a level of sovereignty insofar as they did not try to gain actual independence. So, what this looked like was that the local populace were governed by their own leaders, who in turn reported to the central government, who in turn were subject to Aksum rule. They would then lead their people to adapt and absorb Aksum cultural norms. These leaders were then considered part and parcel of the administration, and they had position and standing in the Aksum courts. They were able to work their way up the social ranks, and intermarriage was actually quite common, especially for the purposes of solidifying a family status. The vassal states were expected to pay tribute to the central government, and it is said that some of this tribute, especially those that were in the form of weapons and foodstuff, were actually distributed to the garrisons stationed across the empire. Which then brings us nicely to another tactic used to maintain control by Aksum, its military. This was an integral and prominent part of the empire. Aksumites placed a lot of importance and pride in what was a very militarized society. The Negusis themselves led armies fearlessly into battle as well as expeditions. The soldiers were respected and were provided for in such a manner to make sure that the chances of discontent and revolt were very, very low. Whenever there were actually flare-ups by regiments, these would be quashed, and the punishments meted out varied from losing any privileges, downgraded ranks, and in some cases being transferred to outposts where there was little chance of gaining wealth and far away from any real action and therefore any glorious victories, which is basically an early and boring retirement before their time. Truly a slow death for any professional soldier. When it came to the troublesome tributary states who refused to comply with Aksum rule, well, then they risked the severity of a military offensive, which could be quite devastating, as they would suffer both loss of life and land, would be captured, made slaves, and in addition could end up being forced from their homes and scattered across the empire, basically forced relocation. So, when it comes to religion, this empire stood along its other African empires of Egypt and Nubia as early adopters of Christianity, way back before the invading colonizers brought it to our shores and then used it as a tool of oppression and looting. But before we get into Christianity, let's have a look at the other religious movements and the environment in this region and its impact on Aksum. I will confess that this was a lot to research, as there are many numerous texts, practices, and sources when it comes to religion in this area. Aksum existed in an era where just across the sea, the Arab and Jewish civilizations were very present and really practicing their own versions of religion, and also there were very strong influences from the Armenian and Roman civilizations. So in summary, there was a heck of a lot going on with the religious influences and practices. So much so that there's a whole study in itself, and it's not enough time on this podcast to really delve into it. So I urge you to please, please, please go and read up on it. It really is quite fascinating, I promise. Now that I've given you that disclaimer, for the purposes of this episode, we shall just look at the highlights, okay? So the Aksumites worshipped the deity Mahram, the god of war and chaos, the triad of Ashtar, who's a representative of the planet Venus, the sea god Behe, and the earth god Mede. These deities supplanted the previous Semitic trio of the Sun, Moon, and Venus, which is common in that region of the Kayberry. The inscriptions of these gods are found in the Matra Stela. Logos of the two planets are actually replicated in the first century coins, which predate the conversion to Christianity in around AD 325. Meanwhile, make sure you go back to part one where you hear a little bit more about the Aksumite coins. They also, Aksumites, these are, paid homage to their ancestors through animal sacrifices. So an animist society. There have also been claims by some to the link with Judaism being a major religion before the advent of Christianity. Guys, let me tell you, this was such a complex area of study with many different theories and very, very strong views and opinions as to the veracity of this claim. So, it's worth noting that if you didn't already know, that there's legit Ethiopian Jews called the Falasha, or the Beta Israel, the House of Israel, who trace their roots back to the Negesta Nagastat, the Queen of Queens, Makeda, who's also known as the Queen of Sheba, and King Solomon, through their son Menelik I. There's a little bit more on that later. Another Abrahamic religion that was found in Aksum was Islam. Aksum was known to be a tolerant, just, and peaceful civilization, and this was something that the Islamic leader Muhammad acted on. And whilst we're here, I might as well give you the highlights of a really cool story about the tolerant nature of Aksum. We find ourselves in the streets of Mecca, and there's a lot of ruckus going on. We rush to see what all the commotion is about, and we see what looks to be official Arab men shouting at a group of men outside a home. As we get closer, our translator tells us. These families are being questioned about the disappearance of a group of Muhammad's followers who were being tracked by the government. The group of 11 men and 4 women included his daughter, Ruqayya, her husband, Uthman bin Affan, and a close relative. So we ask them, why do they care? He says, so those missing are actually part of this new movement by Muhammad. His followers declare him a prophet, and that this is actually a threat to the current establishment. Anyway, he's been doing this for a number of years now, and he's been very closely monitored. And now they've just gone, poof, disappeared. I would suggest we get out of here before we get dragged into this mess. So off we go. In an instant, we find ourselves across the Kayberry, and it is still circa AD 615, in the port city of Adulis. And ahead of us, a group of foreigners are being addressed by an official-looking Aksumite. Welcome to Aksum. I do hope your travel was not too stressful. You can rest now. You are safe. You will find asylum here. We accept all people on our shores. Our lands have long traded with each other, so you are with friends. Do not worry. We grab the attention of the captain of the ship they arrived on and ask, what's going on? Who are these guys? He fills us in. Hey, let me tell you, it was such a close shave as we set off from Shuyab, the Jeddah port. The officials, the Qurashi, just missed us. Otherwise, all may have been lost. These are the guys who have suffered persecution at their home, being followers of Muhammad. And we had to help them out. We have heard that more want to come across, but we shall wait to see if things get better. In a flash, we jump to a few years later, and we meet the same captain who tells us that he has just come back from Jeddah, but with at least another 70-odd refugees. He then tells us that Mecca has sent emissaries to Negus Ashama, the current leader of the Aksum. We head over to the palace to listen in. Shh. Honorable Negus Ashama, we're here to present you with these many gifts from our ruler. We want to lavish you and your nobility with the best and the finest of our silks and brocades, weapons and slaves. Let us work together against the scourge of these refugees on your land. In fact, we will be happy to take them off your hands without any bother, and we'll pay handsomely for any inconvenience that is caused. So basically, they're here trying to bribe to get their people extradited, because the military alliance between the Muslims, as we now know them to be, and the Axumites was actually a real threat. Thank you for such wonderful gifts. Send our greetings to your sultan, says the Negusa spokesman. Our Negusa remembers his time in your lands with great fondness, as during the bitter days of exile, that was his home. Regretfully, you must, however, go back empty-handed. These people are under the care of Aksum and will only leave when they are good and ready. They came for sanctuary, and sanctuary is what they will get. And that is by royal decree. The Muslim representative standing next to us on hearing this exclaimed, "Ah, truly Allah will bless Negusa Ashama all the days of his life." The emissaries withdrew empty-handed. We have to get back home now. I think that's enough drama for the day. And in a flash, we're back. And indeed, the refugees found a safe haven and lived on in Aksum for over a decade before going back to Mecca. Whilst there, they had a peaceful coexistence with the Aksumite Christian population. Today, the Ethiopian Muslims recognize Negus Ashama as a saint under the name Ahmad al-Najash, which is actually said to be given to him by Muhammad himself. He was and is revered throughout the Muslim world for his hospitality and celebrated for providing a safe haven. That's a good story, no? Now, bear with me because I want to flip this around a bit and try something different. Because we're going to hear his name in the telling of Christianity of Aksum, I think it makes sense to meet the famed Negus Azana first and then talk about the empire's main official faith. So, this empire lasted a hell of a long time, with its records from way back before Christ. So there were very many rulers, and that list is like long. So I want to take us even a bit further back before we meet Azana, to a quick detour to none other than the legend, and to some the myth, of Queen Makeda of Sheba, or more commonly known as the Queen of Sheba. Now, because this is just a dope story, of course Afriwetu will just have an episode for her. So Queen Makeda. For now, I just want to mention her here in relation to the link made to the ancient Judaism and the famed Ark of the Covenant, as well as her rule over what is claimed to not just be the Aksum Empire, but also territory in Yemen. You can see how the relationship between both civilizations across the Kebari can be claimed, because her claim to reign is said to be back about 999 to 901 BC. And there are so many variations of her story. But since we are on the continent, our focus is here. Queen Makeda was said to be the mother of Menelik I, the founder of the ruling dynasty, and whose father was none other than Solomon the Wise, the son of King David, he of David and Goliath. Yep, Afriwetu has gone far to biblical times. But to be fair, Aksum is one of the first Christian empires, so why the hell not? Anyway, Menelik I is then said to have brought the Ark of the Covenant back to his motherland. Until today, as far as Ethiopian Orthodox Christians are concerned, the Church of St. Mark, found in Aksum, is the home of the Ark. So with that very rich history, it's not hard to see how conversion to Christianity was really not that much of a stretch, through what was already a very close relationship between the Jews and the Africans, which continued until centuries later when we find Negusa Ezana. And then, as if by a stroke of genius, now let's talk about Negusa Ezana. So, because Afriwetu loves random fun facts, here's one linked to Negusa Ezana. So the word Ethiopia, it is said that he took this term and basically just ran with it. The word itself is derived from the Greek meaning the area inhabited by sunburnt people, i.e. black people. A classic example of this is in the Bible, we know of an Ethiopian eunuch, a royal official from Queen Kadak's court, who was baptized by Philip. Acts 8:26-39. There is some debate if in fact the term Ethiopian was supposed to be used to describe the Nubians. And yes, the magnificent Nubians are on the list of upcoming Africa to civilizations. These Nubians reigned over the north of Africa, including ancient Egypt. Also, this term, Ethiopia, is usually said to refer to Africans in these biblical texts and not just modern-day Ethiopians. End of fun fact. Back to Negusa. Ezana Abreha reigned from circa AD 303 to AD 350, taking over from his father, Negusa Ela Amida, who died whilst Ezana was still a child, and at that stage was considered to be too young to rule. So as is a normal practice, his mother, Negesta Soya, became regent until he came of age. Ezana then came of age and took control formally from AD 325, and was actively expanding the empire through military campaigns backed by his brothers, who led many of these expeditions. It was as a result of these successful conquests, including the mighty and prized civilization of Meroe, that Aksum grew to its powerful empire status and dominated the region on both the continent and across the seas. Yes, seas, because we're talking about dominance felt by the Arabs, Asians, as well as Europeans. A quick aside, one can't mention Ezana and not mention the famed Ezana Stone, which can be found in Aksum. It is a stone monument which documents Ezana's conquest as well as his conversion to Christianity using Geas, Sabaean, and Greek. Greek was actually the lingua franca in that region at that time. Anyway, Ezana's actions set the foundation and wealth which provided the base from which the empire went from strength to strength right into the 8th century AD, taking its place as a leader in international trade and affairs. During this period, Negusa Ezana then converted to Christianity, and quite frankly, if you think about it, Negesta Soya was the key to this conversion and ultimately the reason for Aksum becoming a Christian empire. So, the story, according to Ethiopian tradition, goes. Frumentius and Edius from Tyre, which is now present-day Syria, were captured and taken as slaves. They were en route to Egypt and had docked at Aksum's main port of Adulis. They were then boarded and practically everyone on board was killed, and the two young men were spared. They were then taken to Aksum and presented to the royal court. Here, they were given junior positions, and in time, they worked their way up and became trusted members of high society. On Negusa Ela Amida's death, the young men were granted leave to go back to their homes, releasing them from their bonds. But Negesta Soya asked the two to stay on as she took on the role of regent for her young son, giving them positions in the royal court. At this point, it would be reasonable to assume that she had been exposed to Christianity and who knows, may have even started her own conversion. After a period, both then said that they wanted to go back to their homes. On his way home, Frumentius stopped over in Rachotis, which is the original name for Alexandria in Egypt. Whilst there, he relayed the story of his stay in Aksum, talked about his new converts, and as well about the freedoms he experienced to Athanasius, the 20th patriarch of the Church of Alexandria. As a result, he was consecrated as a bishop of Aksum and returned to his adopted home and the burgeoning Christian community in the royal household in AD 330. He was canonized as a saint, celebrated by the different denominations from the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. He was also known as the Abba Salama. That was his Amharic name. It is in this period of return that Emperor Ezana was then fully converted and declared Christianity as a state religion. And this was an easy transition. So now, as if by magic, we circle back to religion to look at Christianity, having met our key characters who played a part in it one way or another, from Queen Makeda, Menelik I, Negesta Soya, and Negusa Ezana. We'll be right back. knowing about the legends of Makeda and Menelik the First means that we can also appreciate that, regardless of your view as into whether they are somewhat mythical or real, is that there was evidence of Christian Judaic influences in the Nile River south of Egypt that predated Ezana. It is worth mentioning that by the 3rd century, even before we speak of Aksum, Christianity was already present and its center was that of Rakhotis in Egypt. This predated even Roman conversion to the faith and was practiced by those in the lower rungs of society in that area. Aksum's conversion to Christianity and its becoming the state religion is said to be around AD 325 to AD 330. And it is said to be one of the world's oldest official Christian states, second only to Armenia, which converted in AD 301 and was at least 50 years before Rome converted, which was in AD 380. Meanwhile, as an aside, England, it was not until almost 300 years later in AD 597 that it converted to Christianity. This conversion, like many other non-local religions at this period, namely Islam, was top-down. Aksum is also said to have been one of the amongst the first to base its social and political structures based on the holy texts that form the Bible, which is compiled in AD 200. In part one, we heard of this empire's very complex dating system, which is still carried on today in the Ethiopian calendar. And guess what? I'm about to confuse you even further in a few minutes. But I promise I'm going to try and make it as simple as possible, because mainly I also get confused when I look at this. AfriWetu would really love to get any of our Ethiopian or Eritrean fam to send through their explanations. Please use our socials at AfriWetu. So I'm bringing up the dating system here as it is all predicated on the orthodox interpretation of the Christian faith dating system back in the day. The calendar is split into 13 months, 12 of those are 30 days, 1 month is 5 days, and this turns into 6 days during a leap year. This is the summary. According to Ethiopian chronology, the adoption of the 352 as the year of grace came to be known as year one. I explain more about this in part one of this empire. For the purposes here, this year has made a whole new era based on the calculation of when the world began by taking on the Byzantine year cycle. And being in the 11th cycle of these Byzantine year cycles since the creation of the world. So, AD 352 was the end of the 11th cycle and AD 353 became year one of the next 352-year cycle. Yes, I'm aware that some of you will have to rewind this. Please do. I read this and wrote it out several times before I wrapped my head around it and still don't get it. And one more thing about dates. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church really does march to the beat of its own drum, even when it comes to significant dates in the Christian calendar. It celebrates Christmas in January, which is the original date for all Christians until AD 1582, when Pope Gregory decided to change it to the 25th of December. Pope Gregory, he of the Gregorian calendar, I'm sure it's all making sense now. Anyway, again, go and listen to part one. So when we look at Christianity in terms of the relationship with the neighbors, it's a very interesting relationship, and I wanted to highlight to the Yemeni and the Armenians. So Yemen has a history of conflict and cooperation with Aksum, and in the end, it was conquered by Aksum. One of the more well-known conflicts is that of AD 520, when Negus Caleb in Najran, which is now modern-day Saudi Arabia, he went in to save his fellow Christians from persecution and massacre by the then Yemen ruler Yusuf Asa Yata. When he crushed this oppressor, Negusa Caleb was later canonized by the Ethiopian church, and he actually built the Al-Kalis Cathedral, and I believe Al-Kalis means church in Arabic, basically just rubbing in how he had crushed the oppressor. This cathedral was said to be one of the most beautiful buildings of its time. Unfortunately, it was destroyed almost 200 years later. Then the Armenians, who like the Aksumites, were faithful to the Nicene Creed of AD 325, following the Council of Nicaea. The key outcome was in establishing the divine and oneness nature of Jesus Christ, and is the only ecumenical creed accepted as authoritative by the Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Anglican, and major Protestant churches. And it states, God is a very God, begotten of God, but not a creature of God, Son of God, one of nature with the Father, who came down from heaven and took flesh and became man, and suffered and ascended into heaven, who was before he was begotten and who has always been. Yeah, I know you're going to have to listen to that again. So the last thing before we leave this section about the religion, basically Christianity, in AD 2019, UNESCO, the United Nations Office for Culture, recognized Ethiopian Epiphany by placing it on its representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity, stating, Ethiopian Epiphany is a colorful festival celebrated all over Ethiopia to commemorate the baptism of Jesus Christ by John the Baptist in the River Jordan. The commemoration starts on the eve of the main festival on 18th January. The eve is known as Ketera, which means blocking the flow of water for the blessing of the celebrants. On the eve of Ketera, people escort their parish church tabo, replicas of the Ark of the Covenant, to Timkete Bahir, a pool, river, or artificial reservoir, transported by a priest of the parish and accompanied by a great ceremony. The people spend the night attending night-long prayers and hymn services, including the Eucharistic liturgy. Hundreds of thousands participate in the actual festival the following day, which is the 19th of January. The celebration starts early in the morning with pre-sunrise rituals. These are followed by the sprinkling of the blessed water on the congregation, as well as other ceremonies. At around 10 a.m., each begins its procession back to its respective church, involving an even more colorful ceremony with various traditional and religious songs. The viability of the element is ensured through its continued practice, with Orthodox clergy playing a pivotal role. They sing the praises dedicated to the rituals and hymns, carry the ark, and preach the relevant texts. So after all that, let's step into the final section of this great African empire, looking at its demise. The beginning of the end is said to have started in the late 5th century AD, with a number of factors that contributed to the end of this empire, both internal politics as well as external issues. One of the external factors was the encroachment of their lucrative trade routes by the Persian and Arab polities. The former conquered Yemen in AD 570, thus extending their dominance across the Indian Ocean and the Kaibari. Another external blow came when the mighty city of Rakotis fell, negatively impacting Aksum's trade routes, and they were also not able to control their own sources of goods to trade. These losses had a direct hit on the economy, which means that they basically couldn't create wealth or indeed trade. The invasion from the Arabs, who then took over at Julis, the key port in AD 640, which is also later sacked and destroyed in the early 8th century, was another flashpoint. Then if you look at the internal causes, I really want to look at one major event which saw the pivotal change of the ruling dynasty, which also meant the eventual end of Aksum. The story told by Ethiopians is that of the famous expedition that took place by Negus Dangajan. As we know, Aksum had regular military campaigns in their efforts to expand her territory, assert authority, and secure/control lucrative trade and their routes. This particular expedition was basically more of the same, with the key objective of taking control of the lucrative gold trade that stemmed from the Fazgoli mines. To make a long story short, Negus Dangajan failed in this mission. What happened, you asked? Well, I admit that it's still not very clear, but what is clear is that an entire Aksumite army just disappeared, like poof, in the terrain. And the more common deduction based on this is that they went into the terrain and they fell foul of the elements. It was then that one Negesta Yodit, is claimed to have dealt a crushing blow, taking advantage of the disintegrating empire and the weaker son of Negusa Dangajan, who was to rule. Negesa Yodit was actually the granddaughter of Negusa Widim Asafare and took power circa AD 850, reigning until AD 890. Riding on Negus Dangajan's fateful expedition, effectively she staged a coup and paved the way for the Zagwe dynasty that then ruled over a new empire. I do promise that Afriwetu shall have a Legends episode just on her when we look at the Abyssinian-Ethiopian Empire, because her story is just so, so dope. But for now, in relation to Aksum, her role was really seen as the final nail in the coffin. I would also like to point out that this was not the only reason that Aksum fell, so please go and read some more in your own time. But for now, let us just wind up this story, okay? In terms of a significant world event that was happening at that time, in circa 4 BC was the human birth of the Son of God, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. I hear you ask, how is Christ born before Christ's era? Well, in the simplest of explanations, they talk about BC because it is before his ministry began, all in AD 27 and onwards. Whew. So people, I won't lie. This empire was one of the most academic I researched, and that is saying a lot because all of them are very academic. And this one took Afriwetu deep into the world of anthropology, and that was one heck of a rabbit hole, but it was really, really worth it. Anyway, as we're wrapping up, I just had a few parting shots as we close. First of all, I do hope it is starting to sink in how this civilization was an economic, military, and commercial powerhouse. In fact, today you can go and visit the archaeological sites of Aksum in the Ethiopian region of Tigray. You'll find over 100 stelae, with the largest one standing at about 33 meters tall and carved from a single granite block. And I say this because it stands taller than the tallest of Egyptian obelisks. Then, my people, what I loved about this empire is that till today, the claims of the Ark of the Covenant are being held in the Church of St. Mary of Zion in Aksum. The priests of the church are resolute in this, and they say they have it very carefully preserved, so I dare you to go and dispute that with them. And then, my African people, please, please, please don't be cheated. Christianity in its original form came to our shores centuries before the invading colonizers. And in fact, Aksum became a Christian state hundreds of years before it hit their shores, beaten only by Armenia. And then, the Geyer's Bible is the oldest and most complete Bible known as the Ethiopian Bible, which has in it 81 to 88 books. It is hundreds of years older than the King James Version, which is circa 800 years, which only has 66 books. Geyer's is today only used by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church as a language. I feel like there was so much more I could add, but we really don't have enough time, and I do hope that you'll all go and do your own deeper research. As I close, I want to say one last thing because I found this really funny. This empire was very proud of its military history, yeah? And how successful and feared their armies were. In fact, the word armies and people were almost synonymous. That is how much of a military empire it was. So much so was this ingrained that the descendant emperors Johannes and Menelik, in response to the Europeans who, when asking them, how are you and your citizens doing, they would say, I kid you not, that they and their armies were well. And with that, until next time, Mubarikiwe!